Welcome to this week's Doctor Who podcast from Casterbris. And flipping heck, Village of the Angels. That was, I stumbled onto the internet to check if people had responded to our Facebook call for comments, which we'll come to later on in this week's show. And I stumbled across the mention of there being a slightly, quite a cliffhanger. And nothing could have prepared me for the cliffhanger that we got. But before we get to that, James McLean is with me. I'm Christian Corley. That was last week's episode was a bit of a slowdown for Doctor Who Flux, wasn't it? And it mixed things up a bit. And this week it seems to have gone up a gear.
Yes.
Now you said
it has.
Yes, it has. Last week you wondered whether the motivation for the Weeping Angels was different this time, and you were kind of on the nail with that.
A little, but then it did twist it again, didn't it, at the end, which was good.
Yeah. Did you sit there feeling kind of smug when you think, oh, they have got a different motivation this time? Or had you forgotten about the conversation?
No, I'm never smug because I want to be surprised. Yes. So if it turns out what I want, that's not good.
Were you a bit miffed?
Because I mean, in the end, there's three ways that villains end up getting used. The first time, they're on their own, powerful, and get defeated. Second time, they tend to come in numbers, are overpowered and defeated. And the third time normally is the let's pair them up with the hero against another force or another amount of their own force. And then the fourth time, they sort of become friends with the hero, the spike. So they tend to go down the sort of neutering. And it was kind of good in this one that they kind of almost went down into number three, but then kind of turned it into a 2.5. So, yeah, I thought it was a good, it was a good reveal, good ending, good spin around.
Yeah, definitely. I've got to be honest. This, although the first episode was very good, and I enjoyed the second episode as well, and I did enjoy the third episode in a different way. This has been the first one in a long time where I've been really, I mean, this is a cliffhanger of all cliffhangers in many ways, and this is the first time in a very long time with Doctor Who that I've really wanted to see the next episode straight away.
I think it's been smart the way that he's taken his new mythology and actually made it interesting in a sense, because it could have either been very annoying and too overpowering in a way that felt like you were distorting the show, or it could have been just like almost so pointless that you kind of wonder why they did it. And it seems to be made into something which actually has a potential to be interesting. You know, the division has legs which the Time Lords no longer have, and yet they kind of are the Time Lords by the sounds of it. So I think that's good as well. And I also liked, I have to say, and I don't know whether this was intentional or not, but it kind of links back to the second episode of End of Time. You remember with the mother figure?
Yeah.
And her eye, and the way that she had to sort of have her eyes closed, you know, covered by her own hands. And while I don't think that that was to suggest that there was a division, but you could very nicely retroactively link that to this division, to the Time Lords, to this sort of notion of connection to Weeping Angels, which people have thought about for a while. It's not a new thing for people to say, do the Weeping Angels have a link to Time Lords? Because they're timey and, you know, also the End of Time mother thing.
Yeah, and so, there's a line in the End of Time as well that refers to the Weeping Angels, isn't there?
Yeah. So, yes, absolutely. So I think there's some nice, and I imagine they are intentional, sort of expansion of this sort of mythology, which is almost that's been sort of almost there in the show anyway. Like you, I thought it was excellent. It was the first time since I've been a kid, I think I've sort of had that I need to see next week feel. I don't know, to me this season has really felt like the Doctor Who I grew up with.
Yeah,
in so many ways.
The hour long slot is really working, I think, but much better than the 40-45 minute slot I ever did. There's just a bit more space for things to breathe, isn't there? And not to rush around and quick explanation with a sonic screwdriver it's there's just a bit more time Absolutely. For character development and just motivation.
Which is why,
yeah.
I mean, people used to hate the Sonic screwdriver because they thought it was lazy, but you can, I think this really does demonstrate that it was simply there to make 45 minutes manageable.
Yeah.
And as soon as you have a longer story arc, you don't need it, and it doesn't appear as much.
There's some good casting in this. Kerry and myself, my wife and myself, were watching an episode of, well, we've been watching series two of Life on Mars, and two episodes of that feature Kevin McNally. So it was a nice surprise to see him. Well, I mean, it wasn't a surprise, because obviously I knew he was going to be in it, but it was nice to see him in Doctor Who. He was in an episode in the 80s, wasn't he? Was it Twin Dilemma? But obviously he played the Professor Eustatius Jericho, which is not only a marvellous name, he played it really well as well. I really enjoyed watching him.
Something one of my family said, which I thought was interesting, that first when he sort of mentions his service, they were like, stop bringing in, you know, serious real world issues into a sci-fi show, which was a bit of a harsh statement. But I thought it did have meaning. It wasn't a throwaway line. It's very much defined how he acted after that point. And I really liked him. I thought he was a really good character.
Yeah, agree. It was there's this whole idea of quantum extraction in the episode, which we eventually learns, which probably long running watchers of sci-fi and Doctor Who would probably know, work out meant that the village had been lifted out of space and time. So you've got this nice sort of wall around things, but you've also got this wall between periods that you can't cross, and they make a lot of use of that at the end of the episode, which is kind of a bit of a surprise, because I was expecting it just to be another sort of edge into space, which was a nice effect. And this whole it occurred to me earlier on this morning, this is another new way of doing base under siege. You've got village under siege, out of time, with the villains in the village with you.
It was a simple, I thought what was clever about it is it was a simple idea, which was also very complicated as well, but it didn't need to be unravelled. So it became a very good way of sort of being able to get the two sides as well to converse with each other within the story, to set up the ending and to set up some of the exposition about what the whole thing had been about, without it seeming like it was too confusing. It was a very good episode. There were times, I guess, where I wasn't 100% sure I kind of followed some of the motivations of the angel. The info dump of the angel in the Doctor and Claire's mind was perhaps a little heavy.
Uh-huh.
And I was getting old. I was struggling to quite keep up to tabs with what that was actually meaning. But I don't think it mattered particularly.
No, I mean, it was something to do with answers, wasn't it, about the division and the Doctor. But, I mean, whilst we're on that topic, there's been all this talk about the Doctor being, having lives before Hartnell, before the first Doctor, since we met the Jo Martin Doctor and her white TARDIS interior. And then there's been theories about her being between Troughton and Pertwee. I mean, a sort of Series 6B regeneration, which goes into this whole idea that the Doctor and Jamie were tasked by the Time Lords to do some underhand work, which is how the two Doctors worked in continuity post the War Games, but prior to Spearhead from Space. And then you've also got the idea of the War Doctor and there being extra lives somehow there, because it's a white TARDIS. The thing is, there's only one place where there's no regeneration on screen, and there's only one place where there's two places, I suppose, where there's extra space, and that's before and after. Do you have any thoughts about where this all falls?
It falls before Hartnell.
Yeah.
I think people just got to get over that. it's quite clear. I mean, I think they could be quite smart in not making that absolutely clear. So if people find that very frustrating, it doesn't ruin the experience. If they want to fit it between Troughton and Pertwee, maybe it'd be good if they didn't actually specify when it was, so people could do that. I mean, I've no interest in sort of ruining other people's experiences, and there's a lot of people who love Doctor who find this very, very troubling. And I sympathise with that. I mean, I found River Song and the way that she interfered with the continuity very frustrating, and Jenna Coleman's character. But, you know, so I understand what it's like to be there. At the same time, I have to accept that River Song exists, and River Song was married to the Doctor, and River Song was an amazing character who scared the Daleks. You know, I have to accept all that. For me, I think as I've said before, I think adds extra for me, and I like the idea in a weird way, and I don't know whether they're going to pick up on this, that if the Doctor lost her memories or their memories, and maybe the TARDIS did too, but the TARDIS remembered sooner than the Doctor. So the TARDIS was a police box prior to William Hartnell. It has a period where it is a sedan chair or whatever before it remembers its form in a way that the Doctor doesn't. And it sort of is almost carrying on the Doctor's legacy in a way the Doctor can't, because the Doctor doesn't remember what they were beforehand. So the TARDIS is still dropping her into places which need support. Yeah, maybe the TARDIS is like a lobotomized TARDIS, which doesn't remember who it was, but remembers what it used to do, and that is to help people. And so you've got this interesting thing of a character whose mind and personality is absolutely wiped. And then in William Hartnell, you see this slow return back to personality, back to who they are.
Yeah.
Helped along by people like Ian and Barbara. And so in a sense, that also makes it interesting, because it means that Ian and Barbara didn't actually change the Doctor into something good. They just got the Doctor to remember what they were. And again, people might not like that, and I understand that. But I think that's, to me, why I find this acceptable, and it doesn't bother me, and why I don't need to put Ruth in any way. I don't have to do the Moffat thing and sandwich them into our continuity. I can say this can happen beforehand, and that kind of still works, and it doesn't betray who the Doctor is or what the Doctor thinks they are. And I think that's important. That is important to me. I think as long as it stays in character, I'm not bothered about the new information.
Okay. Yeah. I suppose in many ways, I don't really care where it sits.
Mm.
And I suppose as well, I mean, you know, back in the day when there was no Doctor Who on television and we just had Doctor Who magazine, comics, and the old the Virgin New Adventures and what have you, then you'd occasionally get mention of other Doctors, and they might be classic Doctors, but occasionally they would be other Doctors from the distant future or whatever. So there were never Doctors you were going to see, and there were never Doctors you were going to be able to put a handle on. So I suppose it's a bit like that in many ways.
Well, we had Mobius, didn't we? I know that was a throwaway thing,
but yeah,
it was. We are aware that the producers at that time were not considering Hartnell as being the definitive.
Yeah.
You know, we have, as you say, in the New Adventures, we've talked about this before, you know, ideas of the other, Ulysses, there's lots of ideas of previous incarnations, if not regenerations, certainly incarnations, and it was never made 100% clear the difference. But this idea of there being a longer legacy to this personality, which had ramifications throughout Time Lord history. You know, you read The Nth Doctor, Lance Parkin's Nth Doctor. You know, that literally supports everything we're doing here, if you want to take that as canon. Set in a Gallifrey, which could have been before, could have been now, but he deliberately made it that, you know, it was a period of Doctor Who which we'd never seen before. Which
it was kind of an unboot, wasn't it? Because it kind of sits in its own continuity whilst relying very heavily on the continuity that we know for the framework of the whole thing that's going on Gallifrey with the Sontarans and the Rutan.
Yeah.
And then so
there's a lot of freedom within the extended mythos of Doctor Who. So, yeah, to answer your question again, I personally don't feel the need to insert it within what we know. If you do feel the need to, then that's fine. If you can find a spot, that's absolutely fine. I would say that maybe, and hopefully, since Chris Chibnall's decided to actually really expand on this, which I didn't think he would, maybe he will find ways to sew it up a bit more, which will make other people less frustrated by it. Which, I, as I say, as I've exampled, I think there are ways to do that, which is which doesn't betray who the Doctor is and actually adds an extra dimension to it. My only concern would be if it, by sort of creating new mysteries, you unravel the mysteries too quickly.
Yes.
Which would be a shame.
Yeah. I suppose the thing is, it's different, isn't it, now to what it was in the 60s and the 70s. So the production team behind Brain of Morbius, they didn't, I mean, they were essentially producing an advanced children's show and they maybe didn't give it a moment's thought that, you know, but they wouldn't have given it a moment's thought that a few years down the line people were going to be arguing rather passionately about who these people were, just in the same way that when Doctor Who first started and there was, you know, references to being from the future. I think that although those were cut, weren't they, from the broadcast pilot. But, you know, all these things that are there to provide just entertainment are then taken in this kind of very serious sort of canonical way. And then you've got other people involved in the show then dancing around this for years, trying to find new ways of exploring it without being kind of locked into things, such as the opening scroll of Deadly Assassin. That could sit with what we're learning now, couldn't it? History, I mean, what we know about human history is that most of it's missing. So it could quite easily sit alongside what we're learning now about the Doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how, since I wasn't born at the time, did everyone enjoy the War Games? You know, did that frustrate some people, some Doctor Who fans at the time? Did it reveal too much? Did it give them a direction they didn't like? I don't know. You know, it's a show which revises itself to keep interesting. Mm. And right now, it's given the opportunity to have a whole area of the Doctor's world with new enemies, new politics, new mysteries for future writers to think about or not. And I think I'd rather than do that than keep constantly sort of interfering with a timeline which is just complicated and maybe locks out some viewers. I mean, we've always said that with Stephen Moffat, wasn't it? It was always that worry of if you become too firmly embedded within your own lore, Do people watching it lose what you're doing? Mm. You know, how far before Twice Upon a Time, how much does that mean to a lot of audiences? You know, it's a squee fest for fans.
Oh, that's a word I've heard for a while.
You know, so I think this is a good move. And I think it's a nice move as well because it gives a history to the show for new fans as well. That they can know an old Doctor, you know, the Ruth Doctor is kind of like their link to having an old Doctor in a weird way. Maybe, I don't know, I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. There's a couple of other things happening in this episode which we haven't referred to yet. There's the continuing tale of Belle and Vinda and their quest to find each other. I saw something on Twitter this morning that referred to the word Belle as meaning master in some ancient language of Earth. So that's interesting.
Interesting. I hope not, because I think what I like about Belle is that we get a rare opportunity to see a character who lives in the lore of the show without having to be a major historical person or mythological villain.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ordinary-ish person exploring the world universe as it is. It'd be very disappointing, I think, to reveal that that's an established virtual pantomime of a character, lovable pantomime of a character, but inevitably, like the Doctor, slightly pantomime.
Hmm.
So, no, I hope they don't do that.
Okay.
But interesting.
Yeah. And then there's no Swarm this week, but we do have Azure and her passenger collecting people. What do you think? Are they're putting them in prison. Do you... I mean, we saw the implications of passenger being full of people in last week's episode. But, I mean, this is the escape from prison era Swarman is yours. So we're not finding that they're still picking people up for some purpose or other, which wasn't really given a lot of weight. But I mean, it does suggest, because it's post-flood, so that has to be what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming it's good to have hostages, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I like it. I mean, it's very Doctor Who to have a one object carrying loads of people. It's very Carnival of Monsters, TARDIS, it whatever reminds you want
me
to say.
The design of it reminds me of, obviously different colours, but of a Pyramid of Mars,
yes,
mummy.
Yes, yes, it does. I like it. I think it's a nice... I think what I like about this series is it feels very imaginative. It feels quite colourful in its range of what it's doing. I like its world building. I don't find the angels scary. That's the only issue I'd have with this show. To me, I don't know. They're less scary than I think the show's trying to make them for me. But for younger kids, maybe they are.
Yeah.
But I sometimes find that the angels are just a little frustrating because it's very hard for the show to keep them consistent. And there's a couple of times where people are just not looking at them and they're just sitting there. I did notice times where they were directed, the cast were directed, so there was always one looking in their direction, but there were times when they were not and they were still sitting there. And we had that in Angels Take Manhattan, or Angels, it was Angels Take Manhattan, wasn't it? But that had the same thing with the massive Statue of Liberty weeping angel, which waited there patiently while Rory and Amy had their chat. And I think there's always a danger when you create a villain which is so powerful that you have these lapses. Now, you could argue that given that we saw the reveal at the end of the episode, that they weren't that bothered, which is why there were those lapses, because they knew what they were doing. We were told that angels kind of enjoy the chase and being mean. So, you know, maybe they were just casually herding to the point where they could be victorious, so it didn't matter. But they don't scare me. That's my problem. I don't know why. They seem more powerful when they first appeared, but now, even though they are very interesting, I'm not sure why they don't particularly scare me that much.
Maybe it's because you're a grown-up.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go with that. Could be that.
Maybe it's also because they don't really kill you until the second time. So maybe there's a bit of that, that there's no feeling that if they touch you, it's kind of like, oh, well, I've lost a life. But, yeah. You know.
I quite like the idea of being thrown back in time and living in the past.
Well, I think there's a bit of that as well. Yeah. I know they tried to sort of, in the first one for Smith, was it Time of the Angels?
Yeah.
I can't remember what they were called now. Yeah, they tried to shift it that they broke their necks. And that gave them a little more threat, to be fair. And I think turning into an angel is quite a good threat. But yeah, being transported back in time is kind of like, well, we watched this show for that. So kind of like, you know, you're doing the same and just like you lose Jumanji life, but you're still all right.
Yeah.
But they were still well handled. I think, as you said, I think the tone of the episode was really good. The feel of the episode was really good. Everyone had something to do. I thought Yaz and Dan paired off well.
Yeah.
I thought the Doctor worked really well. I thought the supporting cast were excellent. It was imaginative. Yeah, we could pick holes in anything, but ultimately this is kind of like the show that I grew up with, but in a sort of mature, contemporary way.
There is, you mentioned tone, and there has been a few people mentioned that I've seen online, and something that I would agree with, that the, how do we put this, I don't want to say preachiness of the previous series, but that sort of drive to say something, I suppose, the last two series in particular, that's all more or less gone, unless, of course, there is a sort of more overarching commentary that we haven't quite picked up on yet. And that seems to be something that a lot of people are finding to be a bit of a relief. Now, obviously, Doctor Who was... conceived as a show to teach as well as entertain, but I mean, is it fair to say that it's better when it's entertaining than trying to teach at the same time?
I think it's two different show models. I think if you've got a 45-minute show, you sit down to write something like that, you're kind of almost bottled into saying, well, what is this show about? What am I saying here? And that can sometimes become the message. And in fairness to Doctor Who, and it does that, sci-fi is largely about those concepts. I was having a conversation with my sister the other day about Star Trek: Next Generation, and saying how reading up about it always feels like the A story is sort of far more soap drama, because the writers find that more interesting, and they often in the feedback comments tend to sound like they're kind of frustrated when they have to do the B story, which is of some sci-fi wankery. And I kind of feel like, but I used to watch it for the sci-fi wankery, not for the but so I don't know. I guess I'm saying, but they would sit down and that would be the heart of the story, and that would be the message. I don't know. I kind of lost my thread where I was going with that. It was probably somewhere quite clever, but it's clearly I'm not clever enough to go to that clever place.
Well, someone might like it.
I prefer it like this. I agree with you. I personally prefer it like this. Yes, the messages can be a bit hard, and as I say, sci-fi tends to do that. It tends to how many sci-fi short stories do you end with, and then everyone died because they hadn't realized the importance of, how many Twilight Zones are about that? And as you say, there is an educational element to it, so I understand why it was trying that, and maybe it was heavy-handed. Never bothered me, to be honest. I never quite understood why it upset people so much. I mean, I think the one that didn't work for me, and again, it wasn't because of the message, was, I can't even remember its name, the one where we find out it's a future Earth, and it's because of our environmental mistakes that we're there. And funnily enough, I think if that played out now, in this year, it'd have probably had far less aggressiveness to it. Because maybe, funnily enough, maybe it was ahead of its time. Because now climate change has got a far more sort of solid push behind it. So maybe it would have sat better now than it did a couple of years ago. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I prefer it like this personally. I don't really need a message personally, but I understand why sci-fi does that, because that's what sci-fi does. It talks about the bigger concepts rather than like Star Trek, which was doing in the 90s, which kind of was talking about people concepts. Worf has problems with his son because he's disruptive and upset. It's like, okay, that's fine if I was watching EastEnders, but for 45 minutes of Doctor Who, if I've ordered curry, I'd kind of just be disappointed if I'm given fish. So
Unless it's a fish curry.
unless it's a fish curry, and either way, I'd be very upset because I don't eat fish. So yeah, but you see what I think. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I suppose it comes down to what you think the show's about, and I think that's the problem with things like Doctor Who, especially Doctor Who, which is, as you were saying, is there to cater for, families, so for kids, for parents, for adults, for fans, for non-fans. It's such a wide, broad demographic. It's kind of hard to know what's the right thing for it. I don't even know if this is the right way to do it. It feels like it's the right way to do it. The audience reception seems to suggest it is, but what do I know? I'm an old boy.
Indeed.
It's difficult, isn't it?
It is, well, it is difficult, yeah. I mean, we can only really talk within our own sort of experience and circle as well. And although our circle is pretty much James and myself at the moment, we do have some people that kindly, hello to you all, contribute to our Castrovis Facebook page with comments following the episodes. So we'll switch to that now. And Nick Caulfield, first up again. He's very keen to get his comments on. Hello, Nick. Well, that's upped the ante and no mistake, he says. The angels felt a little tired in Manhattan and now don't. Yet at the end of the episode, they aren't the scariest thing. Swarm and Azure are still up to something, but after last week, I have the impression it's immaterial. They'll be reined in. Suddenly, the division is more than just a story to be uncovered. It's the big bad. Enjoyed the Vinda Bell bits. Still liking Dan. We've also got, please forgive me if I get this wrong, Regina Abos. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Best episode in a very, capitals, long time. One that I wanted to watch again the minute I finished it. Yeah, I got that as well. P.S. Get rid of Yaz and replace with Eustacius Jericho. Glyn RB, great series so far. Rich Galtry, easily the best episode so far and probably 13's best outing to date. Lewis David Blaney, glorious, utterly glorious. James was right. The Angels were in need of help, but perhaps not in a way anyone expected. Possibly the best of the Angels since 2007's Blink, and possibly my new favourite twist end reminded me of War Games. And I really like Kevin McNally's Jericho and hope we get to see more. The twist would make a good regeneration. Imagine the Doctor being forced into a regeneration via the transformation. The hands come down and the Doctor has a new face. That would be good. It's probably not going to happen, though, unless we've been sold a pack of mistruths over the past few months. Stephen M. Dorr, I hope I've pronounced that right. Very old school, remind me of a third or fourth Doctor episode. Jeremy M. Ross was excellent. Stephen Shelley said that he'd spoilt it for himself as he just watched Rebel Flesh through to Let's Kill Hitler, and in comparison, the new one paled mightily. Different eras, though, so difficult to compare those. Julian Smith felt it was marvellous. The Division are a nasty lot. And Guy Grist, that was something really special. Bloody terrifying. So that is a very good collection of positive comments about the episode. I think it was similar last week, but I think there was a couple of negative ones. But
more of a balance last week.
More of a balanced mix last week. But this is, this feels kind of like a very memorable Doctor Who moment. And the visuals of the cliffhanger, I think they got them absolutely bang on as well, that slow transformation.
But also, you know, going back to the tension, I think it really worked for Whittaker as well, in the same way it used to work really well for Davison. I love feeling her out of control and spiralling.
Yes.
To stay on top. And that is something Doctor Who hasn't done a lot of, ever, really, I suppose. Well, certainly not in the last 30 years. And I think that helped. And because you're used to, I think the other thing which we haven't said, which we've implicitly said, is the fact that she doesn't win. Is a really interesting thing which Doctor Who doesn't do. I mean, I was 5-10 minutes towards the end, I was thinking, how is she going to turn this around?
Yeah.
And the answer is she doesn't. She loses, essentially. And not just in the sense of, well, they've captured her, she can win next week, in a sense of, if they didn't capture her, they could have killed her. There was really nothing she could do at that point. She had lost. And I think that, again, was quite refreshing. And there have been instances where the Doctor loses, inevitably, to some degree, at the end of every regeneration, they lose, they die. But that felt fresh as well. So the tension, and again, that goes to the format, that you can do this sort of thing. And that sort of builds a tension into every episode here on, because you're not sure whether they will win. And I think that's something which even contemporary television seems to not do enough, is that occasionally it's okay for the hero to lose. Let the hero lose. That's fine. It just means the next time we'll be unsure whether they will win. And that adds a level of interest and engagement.
Yeah, it's difficult to do that with Doctor. Oh, it seems like it's been difficult to do that for Doctor Who, doesn't it? Regenerations aside, the Doctor losing, it really doesn't happen. I suppose the God Complex is possibly one example from across more recent show, although I mean that's over 5 years old.
What's about the I can't remember his name, the sandy one.
The sandy
sand in your eye.
Oh, Sleep No More.
Sleep No More, yes. That kind of had a feeling of losing, to be fair.
Well, I mean, it might be argued that everyone felt losing watching Sleep No More. But
well, I was trying not to go there, but yeah, it was, I mean, to be fair, it has done it before, but I think this is a way where it was done. I think the problem with Sleep No More is it felt conventional. And then at the end, you find out that the thing's still going to do stuff. And it's like, well, okay. But other than that, this could have been just another story of Doctor Who under siege, running from A to B. While this felt like that was very much part of the story, that she loses the story. She doesn't keep up. She doesn't work it out. And then she's betrayed. That's a far bolder approach.
Yeah, agree. Okay, I'm going to press this. Worked. One of the things that we do on this podcast is review Doctor Who episodes. It's not all that we do on Doctor Who, on this podcast. We began Doctor Who, and you know, we've talked about other things over the years. And it says in front of me, the recording file says that this is episode 379, and I suspect it's a lot higher than that. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm actually talking about is that we give our honest opinions about things, and I think it's very important to give an honest opinion and not to sort of jump onto a bandwagon, but actually just say what you feel regardless of what that is, and then sort of work out some sort of common middle ground, and maybe that's the result of your review. I noticed, and we had a little chat about this on WhatsApp, whether we talk about this or not, and I think we probably should, is over on the Doctor Who Companion, which is kind of the community there, is in many ways a sort of successor to Casterbus.com, a website some of you may recall. There's basically an article there called Reminder of the Doctor Who Companion's Comments Policy, and it's an old-timey fandom. There's a lot of division. I'm not sure if that's a pun or not by Philip Bates. And while that's always been true, it feels a bit more extreme at the moment. To be honest, I mean, I have seen some contentious discussions over on the DWC, but and maybe it's the my online activities, but I don't really see a lot of that at the moment. And I know that you kind of don't spend a lot of time sort of engaging with sort of social media and fandoms and things like that, because it's not kind of anathema to you. And it probably is a bit to me, and I managed to get that word out just about. But it's not something that I've really seen much of. I haven't seen much kind of conflict now. I know there are people who say Doctor Who's rubbish because of Jodie Whittaker, and that's patently false. It's not really based on anything other than a dislike of the actress, I imagine. But beyond that, I've not really seen anything that's quote-unquote conflicting, arguing, flaming, all that sort of thing. I mean, not worse than it's ever been in the past anyway with Doctor Who.
I don't know, maybe this recent outing is very good, and it's taken a lot of, I mean, to be fair, I've seen a lot of fans who've said, you know, it's taken Chibnall till now to bring out the goods, which means that they've been probably unhappy, and some of them might have been shouting their unhappiness for the previous 2 years.
Yeah.
And they've honestly said, actually, I'm really enjoying this, which is great. You know, that it's not about fighting, you know, an impossible corner. They've actually turned around and gone, this is delivering what I want. I'm happy to say so.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that, in a sense, is why there's less of it. I mean, there are people, I've seen people on Twitter, you know, who were, especially last week, there were people who were unhappy, and that's fine. You know, as I say, there's points where we're all unhappy. Like you say, it's not a show which is ever going to have a total universal love behind it. But I think that's the reason we're seeing less of it. And I think it's appealing to audiences, our critics, who tend to not have much axe to grind in terms of fandoms, unless they are fans themselves, like digital spy users. I think everything's been fairly positive about it. And I think that's a good thing. I think I'm kind of pleased that with those who've been actively aggressive about the season, about the Whittaker era, many of them have turned around and gone, yeah, this is what I want. And in a sense, that's not to say that they're all great people. I mean, there's a certain, I don't know, consumerist ideology behind that, is that, yeah, I'll kick you and kick you and kick you until you give me what I want. Now it's the show I want. I will praise you, which might not necessarily be the show which is best for everyone. Happens, I do think it is probably the show that's best for everyone, which is fine. But I do think it's good that I'm just happy it's going down well. I'm happy that fans are happy. I'm happy that I'm enjoying it primarily. That's my happiness.
Yes.
But I'm also happy for Chibnall and Whittaker. I'm happy that they can prove themselves. That, you know, that any criticisms that people have had about either of them have a reason to have an argument against. Because, I mean, Chibnall especially was getting a lot of flack. As being unable to write, as being a lazy writer, as being someone who's not a very good writer, all those sort of things. And I think it's funny when people say, well, why has he waited to the last season to pull it out of the bag? And I still, as I've said for a long time, I think a lot of the problem with Chibnall's era, as with Moffat's era, is the format was making these writers, it was constraining them.
Yeah.
it was making them very hard to come up with new ideas and have the space to flesh out those new ideas. And sometimes if you have a great new idea and then you have to wedge it into a 45-minute episode or even a two episodes, that idea is still going to get lost. It's still not going to become, it's not able to really do what it's meant to do. And so I think the attempts to try and make the show something different, and I think Moffat was trying to do this in his last season, are constricted by that format. And I do wonder, and I think we talked about it with Brian at the time, you know, with season, would it be season 9 or season 10? Season 10, wasn't it? His final season. How it kind of felt like if it, they kept him at the university and ran it from there, so the show would have perhaps even felt better. If it'd been like a few episodes less, because there was a few dud episodes in there as well, it'd have felt more consistent. But the Doctor Who wasn't in that framework. And it is now, and it's able. So Chibnall's able to do something different, and I think that's good because it shows you his strengths. He has weaknesses, but it shows you his strengths, and I'm pleased about that because it shows people again why these people are hired. Because sometimes when you're not behind the wall, it's hard to understand why the decisions are done and why people are as they are, why shows end up being as they are. And I think this kind of really shows you that it's not the person. It's the format or what they're writing for, which is the problem. In the same way that you could say, like with Chekhov from Star Trek, to go back to Star Trek, he seemed like a one, you know, you imagined almost like the actor, Walter, could only do that sort of thing. And then he does things like Babylon 5 and he does Bester. And he's able to show off that, no, I can do far more than that. But the constraints of Star Trek meant that I could only do this.
Yes.
So it's nice when you get opportunities to where the system and the structures change to allow the creative components to actually prove what they can do, even if you didn't like the other stuff they were doing. So, yeah, I think that's great. And I think it's always something to remember. Again, like I said, I've never been a massive fan of Moffat's era. But you've got to say that he can write some really strong lines. He's a very imaginative man. And, you know, if you go, you can some of the singular stories of new Doctor Who, which have, you know, are very memorable, like Blink, are largely to do with him. I say largely because I know you've obviously got Russell T. Davies involved in that as well in some form or another. But, you know, he is a very smart man. And so, yeah, I like it. I like the fact that now we're getting to see what Chibnall can do. And it's a shame it's taken two seasons to actually see this. And I'm glad that everyone is kind of giving him credit for that.
We should also give him credit for writing, although the Village of the Angels was a co-written with Maxine Alderson. That aside, he's written 6 episodes. He's basically written an entire series.
Yeah.
Which is no one's done before.
I mean, I've never had a massive issue with Chibnall anyway, but I think, again, like I said, I mean, for some writers, a long form like this would be very difficult, but I think it kind of fits. It fits him. Maybe not. Maybe for most writers, the long form is easier. But then we've not seen it all yet. It might all fall apart in the next 2 episodes. We don't know.
Well,
but so far.
Yeah. That cliffhanger is, I was thinking of it along the lines. I mean, that's a old 4-part. That's an episode 3 cliffhanger, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's episode 4 of 6. So it makes you wonder where it's going to go in the next episode to have any similar sort of impact.
But I think the beautiful thing as well is it's nice when you see a moment where you think, yeah, that's going to be something where he's left his mark.
Yeah.
Where, you know, in 10 years' time, when people look back at the show from their burnt dry craters, that will be, you know, that will be a moment from Jodie Whittaker's era, which will always be remembered as being a key moment of Doctor Who, in the same way that, you know, I don't know, the Ark in Space speech, probably for Tom Baker. The part 3 cliffhanger of Caves of Androzani for Davison. I don't know, McCoy, I suppose you go with rice pudding or the Dalek going up the stairs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or him walking away from the greatest show tent and surviving the blast. You know, all these have these moments which you think, yeah, that's going to become something memorable. And that, I think, is Jodie Whittaker's one. And I think that's great for both of them.
Yeah. definitely. I suppose we should probably have a brief chat about the trailer.
I didn't watch the trailer.
Oh, well, then we shan't.
I didn't. I deliberately. Well, I saw through the from behind the sofa for different reasons. I saw a nude, but I was thinking when I watched the end of that, I was like, that is just such a good ending. I kind of don't want to spoil it by indulging in the marketing. As we've said before, no writer wants a trailer. Because you are giving people a clue which takes away your power as a writer. So I kind of want to go in as best I can, which is going to be near impossible, as best as I can, kind of cold,
Well,
so I can watch it as they would want me to watch it rather than as the promotions would want to entice me to watch it.
sure.
So I'm afraid, I mean, you could always do this bit section after without me there if you want to talk to yourself about it.
Well, no, I'm not going to talk myself about it. I am going to tell you that, to my recollection, there was no mention of the doctor in the trailer, which was interesting.
Nice.
So that aspect wasn't ruined. We will talk about who's in the episode next week, then, I guess. Which I get. I mean, looking at the time, we're pretty much ready to wrap up this week's podcast with a K. So, thanks to you all for listening. Thanks to James for joining me, and we will be back next week to discuss episode 5 of Doctor Who Flux. Until then, it's goodbye.